Cherry Developer News, Lo-Fi Edition for January 14th, 2011. I'm Ken Rimple.
I'm Eric Snyder.
And it's a Lo-Fi Edition because I forgot all my microphones at home.
Who needs them?
I'm a drummer. I'm recording my band. And I said, I'll just bring this stuff home. And hey, new podcast. Okay, so we got a lot to talk about today, Eric.
We do.
One of the biggest things we want to talk about is the Google WebM decision.
Yes.
So I heard about this on This Week in Tech, and also I was listening to a debate on...
Listen to This Week in Google.
Yeah, This Week in Google. This morning I had my iPad up, and in the shower I turned that on. I'm like, wait a sec. Of course, I didn't turn on the iPad in the shower, but put it up next to it and listen.
Yeah.
And they were talking about this, and there was a lot of debate about what the motivations were. We have a link, and the show notes are right, currently until Delicious dies. It's at delicious.com/developernews/29 for the current one. And ZDNet.com on January 12th, they put out Google's H.264 decision. It's all about YouTube costs. So what do you think about this whole thing? Well, why don't we first say what it is? So Google decided that they're going to abandon support for H.264.
In Chrome, which
is the de facto now free licensing for user use video codec.
Right.
They've released the restrictions on licensing for for users who aren't selling, I think, their products on YouTube.
Yeah, and their stated reason sounds very good. Mm. They can spin it in a very good way.
So Google
might not even be spin. I mean, they may actually be this altruistic, but they.
So the issue is though. So they. I'm sorry to jump ahead. So H.264 was the standard, and now and is a standard out there. It's a standard codec for.
It's a standard video codec, right?
So
it's typically delivered inside MPEG-4. So,
okay.
Right. So
what about WebM then? So what is WebM? Before we get into the debate.
It's an alternative.
Okay. It's not H.264. It's another
video codec.
Okay.
Right. So, So I guess H.264 is owned by a patent or a license pool or a patent pool called MPEG-LA. So anybody who – I guess this is where I'm not –
We don't know everything.
I don't know a lot about how the licensing works under this, but if you make a device that includes the codec, like an iPad or a Android phone,
yeah, you have to pay for it.
You have to pay for it. And I'm not sure. I know it's capped at some amount. I don't know the details behind it, but YouTube, for example, has to pay the licensing.
Okay.
Right. So I don't know if that's. This article kind of hints at the fact that that might be the main reason for this switch. Or, it's kind of a cynical view. So you could argue that, well, Google's doing the right thing. And in a sense, they are. So you could argue this is short-term pain for long-term gain.
Okay.
That, really this standard should be open. And, right now, since you have to pay for MPEG-LA for the use of H.264, that it's not open. So, Google's being the good guy here, you could say.
Right.
They really argue. And,
to a completely open format.
They're going to go to a completely open format. Right?
But they're doing it at the expense of everyone who already has a ton of stuff encoded in H.264.
Well, the problem is they released Chrome. It's been out for how long now?
And it's had H.264.
Since the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. So that, to me, is number one, is a bad thing.
Yeah, when formats go away for something, that's a big deal.
If you're going to take a stand, and, don't forget, it's every browser.
Yeah.
Every device supports H.264. So what are they going to do with Android? Are they going to drop H.264 support in Android? If they're going to go with the take this position, they're going to have to.
What about set-top boxes? So you've got the whole Google TV thing, right?
Well, nobody buys that anyway.
I know, but let's say you bought that. Well,
yeah,
I know. Don bought one.
I know.
So we have a person here who bought it. And so if it supported H.264, are they going to rip that out? Are they going to remove a format?
Yeah, so
that's awful.
The worst thing about this, you could argue that, yeah, they definitely are encouraging and supporting open standards, open formats. So that's a good thing. But, the whole movement for the last 2 years, the holy grail has been the use of HTML5, the video tag, which means no more flash wrappers for video.
Mm-hmm.
So, you just stick the video tag in your page, and it just works.
Was the goal for the video tag to have everyone support H.264, or was
no,
there,
no,
was
it's
there
not,
a set of standards?
I don't know that it necessarily...
It would pick the appropriate codec.
Yeah, exactly.
So here's my... Okay, so my devil's advocate question around that is, since HTML5 seems to be like one of those long bus kind of things where it's eventually going to really get here, do you think by the time HTML5 comes out on every browser, do you think that the browsers will support... I think the problem is video.
See, the thing is, HTML5 is already widely distributed on mobile devices.
All right. So now you could argue
that HTML5 is it for mobile devices. Because most mobile devices have WebKit capable, you know, browsers and, or engines in them.
Okay.
And they all support, for the most part, you know, because, you know, people replace their mobile devices frequently. So people aren't generally that far behind.
Right.
So
that's true.
You know, mobile devices, especially the iPhone, no flash, right? iPad, no flash. They're counting on HTML5. They're counting on the HTML5 video codec, video tag, working as you would. So if you happen to visit a site that has a flash wrapper, you can't use that. You can't play videos on that.
Right. Not in an iPhone anyway.
Right. Yeah. And now you can't play any videos that are encoded as H.264, which are most of them.
So wait a second. So let me back you up here because I'm still not getting this. So with an iPhone, you can do it with H.264 with a video tag, right?
With an iPhone, you can, yeah.
So but now you've got, now so then you get an Android device.
Sorry, I meant something like
an Android device. Well, spin forward and say now Android, let's say, you know, Google says in the next version of Android, that the Google Chrome browser, is that what
which,
it is?
You know, they haven't said what they're going to do with Android. Okay. But I mean, you have
could
to
kind
assume,
of extrapolate. Yeah,
yeah.
If they're going to do this,
they're
going to
take
desktop,
a position.
Yeah,
right. So
and all those little Chromebooks, allegedly, you know, that are the Chrome OS books. If they're ever going to get any of those out there, now all of a sudden that's on a separate format. Now you've got to deal with transcoding, right? So if I'm doing Chariot TechCast and I'm doing screencasts.
Yeah, what's the format you're going
to... What format? Do I have to transcode into four formats just to make everybody happy? And by the way, that has been the issue.
Yeah.
Because right now with Chrome, if you go to TechCast... Oh, I'm sorry. If you go to a screencasts plug, .chariotsolutions.com, we've got two out there.
Yeah.
We're experimenting with screencasts. I can't play them. Because I don't know enough about these tags.
Yeah.
I can't play them on a Chrome browser anyway. So now we add another degree of difficulty to this whole thing. And companies like the company that does Episode, for example, they exist because you drop a video format in one thing, you press a button, and it puts it out in five different formats. But they don't really give you much of a guide as to how to tweak the formats.
Well, it's
crazy.
That's why the winner here is Adobe.
because Adobe's transcoding.
So, well, no. Flash.
See,
the thing is, if you... So the whole point was, let's... Right now, I guess it is still most videos. They have you visit a site, you want to play a video. There's a flash wrapper,
right?
Because you know the wrapper, the codec doesn't really matter. The flash wrapper can figure out the codec and play
and say, "Oh, I'm running on this browser, this operating system, and this is the appropriate video codec."
Yeah, I see that the video is encoded in H.264 or you know.
So it puts the intelligence around it, as opposed to a simple tag that says, "Play this OGG video." The flash wrapper says, "Oh, here's who I am. I'll get the right video from the ones I have."
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the way I understand it, anyway. So okay.
But so the thing is, you can't declaratively. You can't if you have an HTML5 video tag in, you can't declaratively fall back to flash.
Right.
You can do it the other way though.
Mm-hmm.
You can declaratively have flash fall back to HTML5 video.
So that means
everyone's going to go back to using flash.
I feel like Sir Gawain, and I'm almost at the Grail, and then
the gate goes,
and I go into the moat, and I get eaten by the dragon.
We have gotten so close to the Holy Grail of video playback on the web.
But you know how software works. It's going to do this to us.
And so Google just took us 10 steps back, in my opinion. Now, on one, you know, if you look at it from one perspective, they're doing... You could say the right thing, but if you look at it from the other perspective, I think they're doing short term, and I say short term, I don't mean that short.
Two years.
They're doing,
because it's going to take a couple of years for people to figure out companies to say, do we really want to go with WebM?
Yeah,
I mean, it'd be great if everyone did, but you know, not everyone's going to want to go with the same video.
The other thing is, so what Google's saying is that one of the reasons Apple's behind H.264 is that they're worried about getting sued for patent infringement.
So therefore, it's a patented technology.
Yeah. So you know, everybody's paying for the license, they're covered.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, Google is kind of taking a risk. They're saying, "All right, we're going to come out with WebM.
It's their own, right?
You can sue us if you think WebM incorporates any patented technologies. We're here."
And so WebM and VP8, which is I guess the video part of WebM, right, is an open format that they've created. Nope, it was created by On2 Technologies. So they purchased a company that did this codec.
Did they? I don't know.
Yeah, in early 2010, they purchased On2 Technologies. I'm reading from Wikipedia. I'll have to put this link in the show notes. They released the underlying patents for VP8 format into the public domain under irrevocable patent promise. and release the specification under a Creative Commons license. So they wholly, I guess, donated this to the open source community.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So which, you know, which is
which could
is
be altruistic, thing. But now it hasn't had a patent challenge, right?
I don't know.
Heard some talk, and this is me putting FUD out there perhaps, but I've heard some talk of, well, you know, H.264 has been down this road. There's a patent protecting it and everything else, and,
right.
and it's all been figured out.
Which is why Apple likes it.
Right, because there's no big open challenge.
There's no
it.
Questions, right.
We don't know about where VP8 or you know, any of these other...
I mean, you know how it
there
is.
There could be a patent suit event that gets that later.
There are patents for the dumbest things in software.
Yeah, for clicking a mouse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, it's inevitable. So the other part of it is, okay, so they're going to drop H.264 support in Chrome. They're going to pick up WebM support. I guess they already have WebM.
Actually, it says in Android, it's WebM enabled from version 2.3.
Okay.
Gingerbread.
So that's good. But, what about Safari now? They don't have WebM support right now.
No, but Adobe now. So I'm looking on the Wikipedia article. Adobe announced Flash Player will support VP8.
Of
so there you go.
Of course
Adobe's
it will.
He's going to mop
yeah.
up.
So now Safari has to decide. I mean, Apple has to decide, is Safari going to pick up WebM support?
Yeah.
Is what's Mozilla going to do? Is Firefox going to pick up WebM support?
Yeah.
I mean, as long as everybody supports, everybody needs to support the most number of codecs that they can. And
right.
if not, they at least need to agree on a standard.
I wouldn't have a problem with Google saying, we're going to WebM for YouTube and go ahead, you know, and we'll support both formats. But the fact that they're ripping out H.264 support from Chrome completely.
Yeah.
Is the bad part, I think, here.
Yeah.
Why remove something you already have?
Well, the problem is, what about all the content that's out there?
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody's
we all
got
have, like, you know, 8-track tapes or God knows things in our basement we can't play anymore. And you've got video formats. I've got my original digital camera has a .cam.
Yeah.
My QV10 back in 98
yeah.
has a .cam format. Adobe doesn't understand that. I even have digital SLR files from 2002 that nothing opens.
Imagine all of the electricity that's going to be, I'm only half kidding here, that's going to be consumed just in transcoding these videos again.
Yeah, I know.
You know?
Oh, that's what Gina Tripathi was saying on This Week in Google.
Gina Tripani.
Gina Tripani. She actually said, okay, and we'll see you in 2 years once it's done transcoding all the stuff on YouTube.
Exactly. So, I mean,
this is a big news item.
It's just, in my opinion,
yeah.
It's
certainly one to watch because we'll see where they go with it. I mean, who knows? I don't know that Google backs down from things when they do stuff. I know Apple doesn't.
You could view this as an anti-Apple stance as well,
mm-hmm.
potentially, because, you know, it
yeah,
promotes,
come up with
it's really promoting the use of Flash.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Apple's not getting behind it, and they're going to get behind H.264 because they already dealt with that.
Yeah.
They're not going to switch. So now you at least have two major competing video platforms now. At minimum, plus then Adobe trying to ride up there and saying, well, if you don't know, pick Adobe, you know, pick Flash.
Right, and let's say Safari and Mozilla decide to play nice and they introduce WebM support for HTML5 video tags.
Comes up the works, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because you can always play WebM through a plugin, like the Flash wrapper or whatever.
Right.
But I mean, the thing is, the browsers natively have to support it through the HTML5 tags. So if they decide to add it, you still got to, everybody's got to get on the new release.
Yeah.
You know, if someone visits
your site.
Well,
let's hope that's the end result, though. Hopefully the end result is that in whenever that comes out, of course, it just pushes the goalposts back.
Well, the problem is now, if you're a developer, what are you going
to
do?
Yeah.
You can't use
the... You have to transcode. The answer is you
either have
to check, get really tricky.
You have to check browser strings like crazy
it's
now.
Awful.
Yeah,
I can see. Whereas before, again, it's the HTML video tag. We just say, oh, go play this video, and it's going to be one of the common formats like H.264, it's just going to play.
Right.
Yep. All right. There you go. Wake everyone up here if you're getting started.
Do no
your
evil,
day.
Right?
Do no evil.
All right. This isn't exactly evil.
Yeah, we don't really know.
It's frustrating.
All right. Well, let me type in my little delicious because I just lost all my information. So we'll put that information up on the show notes. Let's see. So that's article number one for the day. Article number two, and this is just me kicking things around, is the proliferation of app stores. You know, we've got the iPhone app store, Android, all the different phones have their own app stores and
mm-hmm.
such. I'm only bringing this up because I just recently tried out the Apple app store
yep.
and also the Chrome app store because
mm-hmm.
I wanted to try both and get a feel for what they are.
Yep.
And I've got to say, as like a lazy consumer,
uh-huh.
I kind of like the app store concept.
Oh, me too.
You know, and it's one of those things where I can understand if you're a publisher and, you know, you were a publishing house and you would get X percentage.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, Apple has very fixed 30%, I think it is.
Yeah.
Profit. But everyone gets registered there and it's a big directory.
From a software publisher from their perspective, I don't, you know, this may not necessarily be a good thing because now Apple's dictating licensing terms.
Yeah, like you can't have upgrade pricing. You can do in-app purchases, but the App Store is not going to let you upgrade with a cost. So you have to actually register a new copy of the app.
Plus, you have all this infrastructure to deal with, and I guess there's still a review process just like the iPhone App Store and all that stuff. So I don't know if they like it. As a consumer, I like it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so it kind of plays the two sides of me. As a consumer, I think it's a really cool thing.
Yeah.
Because I almost feel like it was the Trojan horse of the iPhone and the iPad.
Yeah.
Was maybe they were visionary and thinking, if we can get this purchasing and store process right on these mobile devices, we hook everybody in. And now on the Mac, my God, we'll put it on the Mac and now millions more people will start buying our stuff. It just seems brilliant to me that, you know, it was kind of the Trojan horse of these mobile platforms. And if you have a Mac and you haven't used the App Store, you should at least download it and play with the free apps. I mean, get a feel for the experience.
I like it as a consumer because it drives down prices, number one.
Right.
And number two, I like getting all my updates and being aware of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
which is a really big deal from one place.
Well, that's one thing I never understood. I used to, my daily work machine used to be a Linux laptop.
Mm-hmm.
I used to run Ubuntu.
And you just do an update, yeah.
Well, because everything was based off of the repository.
Yeah.
So, you know, you'd always know what's out of date and you'd have all the notes and the release notes and right at your fingertips where, you know, generally software on the Mac, you have to launch it first. And And if it's written correctly, it'll check its mothership and see if it needs to be updated.
And then you have to do that for every piece of software you have. There's no one coordinated place.
Yeah.
So it's nice in a way, it's a nice experience for users.
Yeah.
It could certainly make it a little more restrictive place. For people who put their software on the App Store.
Yeah, for sure.
But what's interesting, you mentioned about pricing. So I'm a photographer. My biggest hobby is photography besides the music. And I bought Aperture. It was like, I don't know, $200.
Yeah.
Aperture on the App Store is $79.
It's, volume.
That's it.
Yeah.
And it cut more than half in price. And
sure.
There's the Apple Remote Desktop. $600 per software package, right? $59 or $69, something like that. So they're starting to put, because they know they're going to get volume because they got the eyeballs looking at the software. How many times have you actually gone to Apple's web store and said, what do I want to buy? Never. Right?
Hardly.
Unless you want something and you know you want it.
Right.
You're not going to go to their web store and say, how much does Aperture cost?
Right.
But if it's sitting there right in front of you as the top sales item, and I'm putting air quotes in here.
Sure.
And you see the price and then you look it up online and say, wow, it's like $299 normally or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be one of those, oh my God, it's so much cheaper. I need to buy this because I'm a photographer. They play on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're going to make, I think they're going to mop up. You know, now
the App Store is going to suffer from the same issue that the existing ones do. If you're not in
overkill.
The top 10 or whatever, nobody will ever find you.
Yeah. So right. That's definitely a downside to it. I also played around with the Chrome App Store, and I have to say it's an interesting experience. What it ends up doing for you is really it gives you kind of curated, quote unquote, apps, which this is one way it does it. So they basically let you purchase extensions and web apps. And the web apps are nothing more than pretty looking icons to launch services. So for example, I got the free Google Reader one. What does it do? Guess what it does?
Launches
Google Reader. I'm like, really? That's not an app. that's a bookmark for crying out loud.
Yeah.
The Google Maps one. Okay, I click it. And where do I go? Maps.google.com, right?
Yeah.
But what they've done is, and this is a little bit of a Chrome Trojan horse, is if you go into your preferences in Chrome, and you say, set my settings up and store my apps and my settings and my preferences and extensions and synchronize them.
Right.
They have this really nice little synchronization process that if you have a work laptop and a home laptop.
Yeah, I use it.
Everything gets synchronized.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's kind of cool. Right. And, you know, some of the extensions are interesting. I did buy a chess game for fun because I'm like, all right, I got to see chess on the web. And I think it was like $199 or something. You install this thing and you had to do an in-app purchase, which really just goes to an app store. To download the, and this happened to be an Air application for the full version of the Chess app. So it's not really anywhere near a seamless experience like an app store from Apple would be.
Right.
But anyway, if you have Chrome, you know, we just knocked the video on the Chrome, but if you have Chrome and you use it everywhere,
the sync is
pretty interesting.
If the Chromium OS takes off,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's where this will really come into play.
Yeah, you're really lightweight, you know, computers.
This will be the Apple App Store for Chrome.
For Chrome. I mean, they even have, it's funny, Atari Asteroids, right?
Oh, really?
And Asteroids, it's just a flash game. But it's chrome.atari.com/asteroids. And there's even, and of course now I'm probably killing my CPU as we're trying to record a podcast, but there's also like google.com/Pac-Man to play Pac-Man.
Really?
And there was an app for that. I'm like, really? You wrote an app just to do a launch of that page. So it's strange how they define applications. Right. Browser apps are really URLs in a way, or kind of custom web applications. So anyway, I wanted to bring that up as just another kind of trend. And I know that Android right now, the App Store, it's all over the map because of mobile carriers.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Some carriers, they don't even let you get to the main App Store, right? Right. But if they got their act together, I think that would be a trend that you'd see a lot. You know, you'd see a lot of revenue driven through that. Anyway, if you haven't seen the Apple Mac App Store, kick the tires a little bit, see what you think.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into some of the stuff that you brought in. So there's a big release of JRuby.
There is. JRuby 1. Well, it's release candidate 1 of JRuby 1.6.0.
Okay.
So the big thing for this is Ruby 1.9.2 language and API compatibility.
Okay.
So Ruby 1.
About 2 weeks ago, I think, right? Or a couple weeks ago, we mentioned the 1.9.2, didn't we?
Did we?
I think we might have. I don't think so. Well, if not, okay. Let's go into it.
So, you know, Ruby 1.9 has been out for a little while. Well, for quite a while. And obviously, some of the non-C implementations always have to catch up. So the the CLR version and Iron Ruby and JRuby and all those guys and
right.
Have to catch up. So there's some pretty significant changes. So 1.9 supports treats block local variables a different way. So it's the way things are scoped works a little differently. There's much better instructor use of Unicode throughout. So it's it's definitely a good thing, including. You can give encodings a hint for the Unicode encoding that you're using for your source code itself, so that's always good.
Mm-hmm.
You can have nested methods a la Python. There's just a lot of cool things in Ruby 1.9. But other than that, in JRuby 1.6, there's the big push was performance improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So they reduced the general overhead of making Ruby method calls, which is a big deal.
Oh, that's a big deal.
Yeah, so
you get
an overall, improvement right off the, yeah, exactly.
That's great.
There's experimental C extension support, which is interesting. So so there's a lot of Ruby gems out there. I mean, I don't know what the numbers are, and I know it's shifting every day away from native C Ruby, but I mean, still, it's got to be 90-something% of use of Ruby is regular C Ruby, and there are a lot of gems that have native C extensions. So, if it's experimental, but if it solidifies, that'd be really cool. It'll mean the vast majority of Ruby gems will be available to JRuby as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, one thing that's really cool is Ruby gems Maven support. So it means that you can. Well, first of all, you can.
I'm such a geek for Maven, so
Yeah.
It's sad, isn't it? Yeah.
You can install Maven artifacts with Ruby gems.
Interesting.
Which is nice. Just another way to install.
It's handy.
The cool thing is you can JRuby. So you can have a gem that has a JRuby extension.
Uh-huh.
Right. So, you could have. You have a Ruby gem for your JRuby Rails app, and you have some Java that's part of the gem.
Mm-hmm.
That does whatever. That can have dependencies on Maven artifacts now, and it'll suck down those Maven dependencies.
Like any other Maven thing. Exactly. Yeah, I see here an example in Charles Nutter's blog. It's the example he gives is like gem install quartz colon quartz.
Yeah, so those are Maven coordinates. Yeah, exactly. So that's pretty sweet.
That's really cool. Okay.
And better Windows support. So, there's a lot. They improved their CI process to focus a lot more on Windows.
Yeah.
So now they're gonna, they're gonna really make sure that stays nice and solid.
Mm-hmm. 2,000 commits and 265 issues resolved.
Yeah.
They've been doing some work.
They sure have. Yeah. Wow. They're busy guys.
So okay, so you have articles. So the one is Charles Nutter's entry on Engine Yard about it on his blog.
Right.
And what's the other one? It's just an alternative post on it.
Yeah,
Developer World calls it the biggest release ever, upgrade ever.
Well, for JRuby, sure.
For JRuby, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's very good. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right, so that's that. Let's see here. There's a little tiny tip that we have on Spring. It turns out that if you've been using Spring all this time, perhaps, and I have to go back and see what version, but in Spring 3, there's a Spring Greenhouse project as a demo project. And there's this piece of software in Spring, this little bean that automatically translates values from properties files. It's called the Property Placeholder Configurator Bean.
That's a very Java-ish.
It's a very name. Long name. We Spring people like long names.
Yeah.
So we have many names like Aragorn. And so you mount the bean, you point to the properties files, and you can use like ant style, dollar sign brace, foo, and it'll go look at the properties files and find the value.
Right.
Well, it turns out that if inside of that value in the braces you put question mark and a value, that's the default. Little tiny
thing.
I never knew
that.
Neither did I.
You know how helpful that could possibly have been?
It could be very helpful, yeah. So it turns out that Gordon Dickens, our other partner in crime for training, he was looking through and he saw that, he went, wait a second, and he tried it out and it works great. So there's an entry on his blog, gordondickens.com, under the Technofile blog, and I'll post a link to that
there. I've hacked around that a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Interesting little thing. So also another bit of trivia, I don't know if you know this, but it will load from the properties in the system properties, and it will also...
I did know that.
Yeah, you can also get it to error out if it doesn't find a property, or get it from the environment variables. So if you're a Spring developer, it might help to spend 15 minutes looking at the Java doc for a property placeholder configurer, because there's a lot of hidden gems hiding in there. So
cool.
All right. Okay, so let's see. Closure developer no longer asking for funding. This is interesting. So Rich Hickey had an entry on his blog that I guess he's been getting a lot of... questions in the community on enhancements and need for getting it out quicker or doing changes or something that they want to move Clojure along.
Right.
But Clojure is his project.
It is, yeah.
And so he's actually not going to go forward doing any more funded development from outside donations.
Right.
He's actually going to just fund it with his own consulting and work. So I find that to be interesting.
It is interesting. I mean, Clojure is, you know, it's a one-man show, basically.
Yeah.
So, which, you know, has its positives and negatives.
Sure.
Right? So some of the positives being, you know, it's a very singular vision, and it's, you know, it doesn't get muddled, and, you know, he if you like the direction that he's taking it in, I mean, he does it very well. So
yeah, I mean, it's got a lot of fans. I know
yeah,
that.
Yeah. But I can understand that. So, you know, if you take donations, then you might feel compelled to respond to the direction that the donors would like you to go.
I think it's admirable that he says, in my opinion, if I was hosting an open source project and it was my baby,
sure.
Right, and I was getting a lot of traction with it and it was working, and I was taking donations and I got a lot of push, and I felt like it was going the wrong direction, I think it's admirable of him to say, you know what, forget the donations, I'm going to really focus on what I think is right for the library.
Right. Now, I guess what it doesn't say is, you know, you can still contribute, right?
I mean, I'm... You know what, I don't know.
I mean, you know,
contributing.
This speaks just to monetary donations.
Monetary, right?
Right. The influence of monetary donations, right?
He's now saying, right. So, and actually, he has a large. And we shouldn't call it really a one man shop or one man show, really.
No. I meant in terms of
sponsorship or
like a benevolent
program,
like a BDFL, like Python or Ruby would have.
Exactly, because I'm looking at the actual.
It's a huge list.
It's a giant list of people who have contributed.
Oh yeah.
And to his credit, he lists every single one.
Oh yeah,
and it looks like he's listing every single one. But it's more the financial contribution.
Yes. Yes.
So that's what we're really talking about here. We're not making any kind of comment that he's the only person working on.
Oh, no, no.
But that's admirable. If he feels this is the direction he needs to go, and he's got the vision, and he's in charge, it's good to say, all right, you know what, we're not taking monetary donations, because then otherwise you're going to assume that a piece of that is what you expect it to be, and I've got a direction where it needs to go.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting piece of news,
and very,
I think, very admirable to do it that way.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else?
The Tiobi article?
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, it's Tiobi software. We got the 2011 January Programming Community Index. So, if you were just a betting man, what would you think the top, of course we're looking at it, what would you think the top language would be before looking at this in the Tiobi index?
I would say Java.
Or COBOL. Yeah.
No.
I'm just kidding. COBOL's not even on the list, actually.
No, I would definitely say Java.
Okay, so Java is number one.
Yeah.
And then interestingly, the very next one is C.
Not too surprising.
Yeah. Followed by C++.
Right.
By the way, Objective-C is down on 8.
Oh, well. That's pretty high.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, it's funny. The first two, Java and C, haven't moved since Jan 2010.
Right.
But Objective-C went from 12 to 8 because of probably all the Mac, iPad, and iPhone developers that have entered the market.
Right.
But your baby Python's up there, number 5.
Yeah, so it's actually the fastest growing of 2010.
So number 7 and number 5.
Okay, I don't.
I knew there was a reason why you brought this up.
This is why. So I don't know what.
Damn you, Eric.
Tiobi's method. I don't know about Tiobi's methodology.
Yeah.
I didn't do any research into it. So
no,
I don't know.
I've heard people, you know, say you know, negative things because they say, oh, it depends on how you index it.
Yeah, obviously you can manipulate these numbers.
Sure.
So, but whatever their methodology happens to be.
As long as it's consistent from year to year, then there's a trend there.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Right, exactly. So, Python has grown.
Yeah, from 7 to 5. I mean, getting to that level, I mean, because you can look at it this way. Objective-C, right? For the ratings right now, that's 3% of all the messages that they're looking at in their forums or they're looking at. To get from number 12 to that, 12 right now is 1.2%.
Right.
So that's like more than 100, you know, almost 200% additional traffic.
Right. So for this growth, they actually call it the programming language of 2010. Woo-hoo-hoo. Just because of the rate of growth.
I knew there was an angle that you had
that's
for
it.
Python in
I'm
there.
I'm telling you.
Well, I can laugh because Java,
yeah,
17% of all the messages.
Oh, yeah.
And it might be things like, why am I out of memory in my Java VM? Why can't I restart?
Yes, like I said, I don't know how they come up with those numbers.
I know.
I guess I should research it. But no, these are all A-level languages.
C#, number 6% of messages. There's a lot of people doing .NET development, I guess.
Sure.
All right. Well, that's an interesting one. That's up on Tyobi.com.
Why? Wait, scroll down.
Go ahead. Let's keep looking at these.
Why is assembly?
Listen, man. Don't harsh on my mellow with the assembly.
No. I'm just wondering why it's really, why has it grown so much?
It hasn't moved. Wait a second. It hasn't moved at all in a year. But remember, it's only 0.8%. So it's probably people like kernel
developers. No. It was not even on the chart before.
Well, why'd they put it up there?
Because now it's at 15.
How did assembly go from nothing to 15?
Something must have changed in the industry. Like embedded stuff, maybe? I don't know.
That's very interesting.
That is weird, isn't it?
Hey, Tayobi, we'd love to hear from you. You're never going to listen to this blog, but if you do, we'd love to have you on the podcast to discuss this. So if anyone knows someone from Tayobi, get them in touch with us.
Yeah,
and there's other things, too. Like, for example, I'm looking through this. This is fun to do. Just look at this with your buddies at work. Lisp is it's actually one move from 18 to 13. I'll bet all that movement for people going and looking at the...
But does that count? Is Clojure count, or does that fall under Java?
Well,
would that be its own programming language?
Clojure itself isn't even on this list that I see.
Yeah.
But Clojure's Lisp derivative, so maybe people are asking.
It would probably be under its own.
And Groovy fans such as myself, Groovy's not even on the list. It's not in the first 20. So sorry. Yeah. It is the way it is. So interesting. I would love to get these guys and find out. In fact, I'm going to make it an effort to find these guys and see if I can get one of them on the phone and get an interview with them to see how they've actually done the methodology and what they thought about the whole process. So, very cool. Pascal, man. Pascal's hanging in there.
I love my Pascal.
You know what?
I don't use it anymore, but I love it.
Yeah, it was one of my first languages, too.
Yeah.
I remember I had the Metacomco Pascal compiler for the Amiga. I liked that. And Turbo Pascal years and years and years ago. Yeah. Cool stuff. Okay, excellent. Let's see. We have a couple things going on at Chariot. We just did a Hibernate with Spring course. I want to kind of outline the fact that we do a lot of Spring training here. Check at if you go to chariotsolutions.com/education, you get all of our training courses in Spring and also in Maven. We're getting a lot of traction with the Spring stuff right now. You can also go to springsource.com and look at their training and look at the stuff in Philadelphia. That's us. So there's that. If you're looking for work and you're looking for work in the kind of stuff we do, which is Java, Ruby, a whole bunch of different open source technologies, and you like doing consulting, we do have an open house coming up. If you go to chariotsolutions.com, I don't know why that's not filling in automatically for my browser, there's an announcement about an open house on January 26th, and there's also going to be one coming up in February. You could stop by if you're in the Philadelphia area and meet us, and we'll talk about what we do. Eric and I are going to both be there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can get a feel for what's going on at Chariot. So if you want to reach us, you can hit Eric is at time, the number 2, code, mm-hmm. on Twitter, and I'm at krimple on Twitter. You can also, if you want to say a nice thing about the TechCast or other, you can use at TechCast to tweet that. And so... trying to think of anything else that's going on. I think that's pretty much it, right?
That's it, yeah.
Okay. So for another week, that's the Chariot Dev News. I'm Ken Rimple.
I'm Eric Schneider.
Make it a good week.